If everyone could please find your seats. There's some empty chairs in the back if people are still looking for some. Welcome back. I'd now like to introduce George Young, founding partner of Calypso, who will lead our next panel discussion presented by Calypso, entitled How Retailers and Manufacturers Can Win with Collaborative Innovation.
Thank you, Lauren. What I'd like to do to start off today is to first introduce the panel, and I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves. So, Helene?
Good morning. My name's Helene Angelis, and I'm currently principal with Calypso, formerly Vice President of Customer Business Development with Procter & Gamble, and most recently President of an industry group called the Network of Executive Women. And I'm delighted to be here.
Hi, I'm Karen Sadik, Executive Vice President of Aerosoles. We're a women's shoe company with retail and outlet stores all across the country and international presence as well, and a direct-to-consumer retail and catalog business, as well as a wholesale business.
Good morning. I'm Julie Hamilton with the Coca-Cola Company. I currently lead our global business with Walmart, and for the past 6 years have worked in the global customer space, and really I'm excited to be here, and thank you for having us.
Cameron Jones, Unilever, VP R&D for Information Management and IT. I've worked all over the world, Japan, US, Europe, in various roles all across R&D.
Okay, thank you. So I want to start off the panel by introducing it. My firm, Calypso, is a management consultancy exclusively dedicated to providing services in helping companies deliver on the promise of innovation. So we're exclusively focused on product development and innovation. In addition to being the president of the firm, I lead our CPG and retail practices. And one of the things that is always top of mind in this area is how retailers and manufacturers can win with collaborative innovation to bring new products, services, store experiences to shoppers and consumers. So we recently completed a study. Helene Angelis was the one of the co-authors of the study, along with my other partner, Mike Friedman. We're going to use some of the leading insights from that study to guide our discussion. And what I'm going to call upon the panelists to do is to please, as much as possible, in your responses, provide real experiences. One of the things also that we heard in the initial talks, I thought it led very well up to this panel. We heard from the CEO panel that in a downturn, the importance of innovation is paramount. And we just heard from James Wright something that's really a great lead into this panel. He said, quote, "Collaboration is not a natural state of affairs." And it's certainly not necessarily a natural state of affairs between retailers and manufacturers, although one would think it ought to be. So with that, Helene, I'd like to ask you to give us a little background on the study and maybe some of the top-level insights.
Great. Thank you, George. Yes, we conducted the study over the last 6 months. We interviewed 30 companies, almost 40 executives in the Fortune 500 companies in the CPG and retail industry. And we had some key hypotheses. Well, first of all, there's the reality. 90% of the industry's new item initiatives do not meet their stated goals. So we know, as we talked opportunity, whether you're in a down economy or an up economy, that's huge. Secondly, there are companies that do this well, and we found that there were some interesting business results, anywhere from 15 to 20%, so in terms of business growth potential from this. So we wanted to understand that better. And then, importantly, what were some of the barriers that were not allowing companies to do this? And in talking to these executives, we found that almost 100% said that, you know, collaborative innovation is truly important. And yet, when I really dug deep and I asked those executives, and those are executives anywhere from CEOs to COOs to folks in marketing, R&D, we found that only 12% actually got the insights of the key strategic customers back into their innovation pipeline. So think about that as an opportunity. And as we looked at, you know, why those opportunities were not being really translated into business results, what we found were really some key thoughts and insights. First, there wasn't always a CEO top-down approach in all companies in terms of mandating this. Secondly, the actual requirements of the strategic customers were not put back into the actual stage gate innovation process. Thirdly, there weren't necessarily really tight metrics and processes, as well as incentive systems, both from the seller and the retailer, to actually do this in the right way. And finally, there was not always the understanding from the not only multi-level but multifunctional resources, both at the retailer and the manufacturer, to make this happen. So in sifting through all this data, we really found there were really four best practices. The first was, sounds obvious to all of you, but really, and thinking about it, making it a stated strategic goal that everybody in the organization understood, and actually all of the top executives would actually be measured on that. Secondly, finding a way to conduct collaborative business planning. And again, that can run the gamut from, you know, just kind of simple joint plans to very elaborate, what I'll call strategic long-term planning, although as we heard earlier, long-term could be the moment today or tomorrow. But the idea that you would actually share your future innovations in a longer-term standpoint. And thirdly, really ensuring that you had your own house in order and aligning the organization, making sure that everyone really understood the importance of this and understood where it stood as far as their own metrics were concerned. And finally, building trust. Probably the most difficult thing to do in talking to all these executives in terms of building it, and also the easiest thing to do to lose. So those were sort of the key insights and the four best practices. And we have some folks here that I think can share some real-life examples.
So let's start with the first best practice that you cited, which was to have a well-understood and aligned strategy. So I'll just throw it out to the panelists. What have you done? What have been your experiences in getting the company aligned in a collaborative innovation strategy, and also aligning yourself if you're a retailer with the manufacturer, or if you're a manufacturer with the retailer?
Well, one of the interesting collaborations that we've just started at Aerosols has been with a very large company in India, one of the biggest companies actually in the world, that are very diversified and want to get the manufacturing of the footwear business much more established in India, which is very established in China and really in infancy stages in India. At the same time, this company also has about 40 large department stores in India and growing. And we're working with our partners in China to work with India to get the factories going and best practices on the best production of the footwear business and the women's shoes. And then at the same time going to distribute and sell the Aerosol shoes to the retailers that they own, the department stores in India. In order for something like that to happen, which is a fantastic opportunity for our company, we have to have, as Helene mentioned, the commitment from the CEO, and we also have to work very closely together as a company and as a team. You know, I'm sure all of you have divisions in your companies that sometimes have a lot of silo effects going on, and we work very hard to try to come together as a team, because if we don't work together to make this collaboration happen, it probably, there will be splinters and it will fall apart. So this is something that we have to have a clear process in place. I think a timeline is very important, that you look at where you are on that timeline and make sure you're following the plan laid out and the vision by the CEO, and making sure that you're able to get the international partners to comply as well. Because if you're not getting the commitment as well, which is so important, as well as the trust, I think those two words are so important to make something like this happen, because it's not just India and the U.S., it's also China, to make sure that they've got the commitment to help India get the production of the shoes.
That's great. Just to build on that, because I think you're exactly right, one of the key things that we've really learned is that that commitment at the top and having a vision. So if you're working with a customer, so between customer and supplier, really having a joint vision of why you're actually doing this, so understanding the whys, then having alignment on the hows and the whos, and then the whats. And a lot of times we like to jump in with the whats, and that's where you can lose your way. And a good example that I'd like to share, and this is kind of a tactical one, but it's a real-life story, and then sometimes in real life, as we all know, it's not always that pretty. So this has a good and a bad to it. But several years ago, we were very excited about the opportunity we had with recycling of PET, bottles such as this. And we had just opened the largest recycling PET plant in northern Mexico. And we were working with several of our customers and said, gee, this is great. There's got to be something we can do with this to really close that loop so that end-to-end you're actually, you know, turning it back into something of value. So we got very excited about this collaboration, started running down. Really, that was our only vision of, let's do something about this together. This will be great for the environment. You know, we'll save the world with this kind of thing. And, you know, our technology and our capabilities weren't quite there where our vision was. We did all the right things in terms of, you know, we put guiding principles in place about how we were going to collaborate. We had a structured process, to your point. We had metrics. We had accountabilities, you know, down to who did what on what side. And, you know, the project was still a big, big struggle. We tried to create a plastic recycled PET box that actually held 6 Coca-Cola bottles in it, and that was 100% recyclable. You could actually open the lid, put ice in it. It would hold the ice, and you could take that for your holidays. And this was, we were going to pilot this in Mexico. Well, the technology wasn't quite there, which I'm sure you can attest to, but you know, we couldn't get a handle that worked, and it was really tough. But we did get it out into the marketplace. And the key thing that we learned, I think there was two things. One, the consumer really resonated with it. They said, yes, this is a right vision. But we also learned that in spite of adversity and when things didn't work well in the collaboration, that we could still do it and get through it together and then build on those learnings. So, you know, you flash forward several years later, and we're doing some great things in collaboration with Walmart in Latin America, both in Brazil and Argentina, where we have created recycling stations at their stores. We're employing cooperatives from the very poor areas, and they're actually taking the bottles back, sorting it. They're being paid for that work, so it's a big contribution back to the economy in those local areas. And then it's going back to be made into blankets, which then the sales and profits from that benefit the local cooperative. So we recycled almost 20 million PET bottles and have made a significant difference, and that's all from that first collaboration, which if we didn't, I think, have a vision and didn't learn from our mistakes, we could have stopped several years ago and really not gotten to that. So a real-life example.
Okay. Just a point I'd like to make about strategy, and it's really strategy into action. Yeah, we've got to be outcome-focused. And, you know, if you start with the CEO and Unilever all the way down, we've talked for years about customer. One of the first things, and we have a matrixed organization, which is really the countries or the regions and the categories. And one of the things, the tipping point for me, I would say, in our organization is when we started to report the results in countries and by customer. It doesn't half make an impact, yeah? When you are putting your resources, your innovation plans behind countries, and you're getting a certain growth rate, yeah? A certain incremental turnover, and then you bump your big, you know, you put your big customers down there, the Carrefours, the Walmarts, the Tescos globally. and you look at that, and that has quite an impact. So the words have always been there, the speeches were there, but one of the key tipping points was actually you put those graphs up when you're going into your leadership team meetings. Where do you want to put your resources? Where do you want to put your innovation plans? How are you going to drive the right ROI? Yeah, really, really important.
And that, I think some of these examples illustrated one of the points, which was that you have to have your house in order before you get serious about collaboration. Because if you go into this spirit of collaboration, spirit of building trust and commitment, is you have to be very open. And so if there are some things that you'd like to have improved, your collaborative partner is going to see those things and experience them. I'd like to talk a little bit now about some of the tactics. One of the biggest insights was the importance of doing collaborative business planning well. James Wright, I think, also mentioned that in his talk. So what has been your experience with collaborative business planning? What tools have you used, and how have you built the capability?
You go.
Okay, I'll take that one.
And
in no way would I say that we are anywhere where we want to be. This is a work in progress. I think it's always a work in progress, and I think you strive to get better at it. And we've got a long way to go to get where I think, you know, we would want to be. But I would say that, you know, being a matrix organization, we work with our bottling partners, so there's that entity as well. We're a franchise system that, you know, really breaking down the silos, including people early in the process, making sure that everybody's got a seat at the table early, and that you value and listen to that input has been a key learning. A lot of times, you know, you move at a fast pace and you kind of run off on your own and then try to get people in later. And we've really learned, you know, you've got to make time for the production team to be part of it early on. You can learn a lot from them. We've shown that. And, you know, I think that building a way or a process or a routine about how you share best practices throughout the organization really helps build that capability. So where has it worked? Where has it not worked? And what can you do? And being a global organization, we do a lot of WebExes around that. We actually have countries, you know, get on, and the people who have been involved in it share those practices with each other versus us actually trying to tell their story for them. So I think that that has really helped us learn, not, you know, continually repeat the same mistakes, and to start to break down kind of the not invented here syndrome.
Mm-hmm. I think building on that, one of the key questions you have to ask is, what's your organization going to do to facilitate the collaboration? And one of the things that we've set up, and I'm sure most companies have, is we have a customer insight and innovation center. It's a retail reality caves. There's lots of technology there. The technology in itself is not important. What is important is you're getting into a dialogue and a discussion, and you're using the technology to prototype, to facilitate the discussions, to make decisions. And if I look to a real life example with collaborating with Walmart here in the US and the All Small and Mighty product that we introduced with Walmart, you know, traditionally we'd have gone along and said, look, your agenda of sustainability, our vitality agenda, great, let's push it through. But we went to them and said, gosh, how do we grow the segment? How do we grow the market? And we then got the benefit from that. But that was really a real joint effort, and it was a lot of free publicity for us and a lot of push and spend by Walmart, yeah? But we engaged in them very early to create the market, to create the demand, and then put the products there. But again, do think about how you're going to facilitate that collaboration. And technology can play a part, but it's technology to drive outcomes and business excellence, not technology for technology's sake.
I agree with both Julie and Karen. I think that my company, being that we're vertical, but we distribute to our own retail stores as well as sell to Macy's and other wholesale accounts, a lot of times in our organization, if we're not all on the same page together, we can't execute what we'd like to as a company. And to just confirm, in my opinion, what Julie said, we have to get everybody together and let them talk about their uniqueness of their individual businesses, because even though we're one company, each of our divisions have different practices and different success stories on what works and doesn't work for them. And, you know, retail is one of those businesses that's just constantly changing, and you have to be always open to approaching something in a new way, in a different way, even though it may be something that didn't work 10 or 15 years ago. I've found many times in my career that something that was a complete failure 15 years ago, it may be time to look at it again. Although with retailers, we're always looking back and saying, ugh, that was horrible, that didn't work, you know? So they get their backup, and they're like, oh, I don't want to try that again. But I think if you're open and listen to everybody's challenges and have a really good discussion, and as Cameron said, in advance, I think you can start to move towards getting everybody to feel like they're part of the collaboration, feel like they're part of the group. Because if they're just executing something that the CEO might have mandated, I don't think you get the passion or the involvement. So if you get everyone involved, we found a lot more success with that as well.
Can I just build? I think there's another point here, which is about recognizing each other's strengths. Mm-hmm. So let me give examples. I mean, I sit in R&D, and it's great, you know, in the innovation team, and we get very precious about our brands and brand equity and how we build products. And, you know, to me, I think it's normal for a middle-aged man to spend 20 minutes staring at a health and beauty counter when you walk around on a Saturday morning. I don't realise that's not normal, yeah? And where customer bring a really interesting insight is, you know, and it might sound very flippant, but, you know, it's a shampoo, yeah? And helping accelerate us get these products to market, yeah? Now, you will not believe, or some of you will, how much time, money, and effort we have discussions over shades of Pantone references and everything else, yeah? So I continually try to bring in the customer to give me what I call the Saturday morning head view, yeah? Which is the normal consumer view, not intellectual brand marketing and R&D going on off at a tangent. So, yeah, recognize each other's strengths and celebrate it, bring it in, and don't try and change them. Because a lot of times you'll find initially, you know, I want to hear your opinion, but I don't want to listen. Yeah, I want you to change. I'm right. No, let's listen. Yeah, so just recognize each other's strengths and build on it.
Okay. On the break, Karen, you shared with me an interesting collaboration example of things that you're doing, which is kind of retailer to e-tailer. Maybe you could share with the group that story.
Sure. About a year ago, I took over the responsibility of merchandising and buying all the inventory for our .com accounts. And what we deem those as companies like QVC.com, ShoeBuy.com, OnlineShoes.com, Macy's.com, which is the sales are basically reported out of the wholesale division, which I'm not necessarily a part of, but the orders come through our company via EDI. So I've been able to successfully grow that business by over 100% in 1 year by instituting the same types of strategies that we run in our retail stores and in our catalog business, and taking markdowns on product that may not be performing as well as other styles, and letting those accounts be able to take advantage of those promotions and pricing. And through that, they've been able to drive their business with us that much more. In fact, I think we're one of the leading vendors with ShoeBuy.com, just based on our business over the last year and a half. So it's been a real win-win for the company, because we're able to obviously grow our business and get more aerosol shoes on women's feet, which that's our goal, is to have our shoes on every woman's foot. But also we're making these other companies profitable as well, and driving their total sales volume at the same time.
Thank you. Helene, could you comment on what you meant when you said you have to have your house in order? What does that mean?
It's really important not to overpromise. And a lot of times the companies that I talked to really understood that, you know, they may not be ready to really do this collaboration to the degree that each of the panelists shared. So getting your house in order really meant, first, is it a strategic choice at the top? And as Cameron mentioned, you know, are you reviewing the results of your top customers just as you were viewing, you know, your brands or your geography? The third thing that we found in terms of getting your house in order is, you know, is there a repeatable process that will sustain itself over time that will not be dependent on individuals? What we found in my interviews with these companies is they could give me examples, you know, this great person here, Julie Hamilton with Coca-Cola or whatever. You have instances of greatness. The relationship is, you know, maybe person to person, but if those individuals change, you don't have that repeatable process. So obviously having the right people is important, but the process and the metrics. For example, you know, do you have the right metrics? And the reward system, you know, R&D is rewarded for coming up with ideas. Well, what if the retailer comes up with an idea that could be bigger and better? Are your internal reward systems aligned to be able to actually, you know, evaluate that idea openly and honestly? And on the retailer side, you know, are their reward systems set up so that, you know, they're not just rewarding, you know, lowest price? And what we found is, you know, whether you're looking at this from a U.S. standpoint or a global standpoint, and Cameron, we had this discussion that, you know, the world view is different outside of the U.S., and how you might go about this is going to look very different in India than it would, for example, in the United States or Western Europe, where you have such a high concentration of some of the retailing formats. But the approach and the process is very similar. You just have to apply it to the unique circumstances. So we would highly recommend, and we've got the actual study here, so you could all take one on your way out, where we really help you identify what are the elements of getting your house in order and what are the questions you really need to ask yourselves, both from a manufacturer and retailer standpoint, in terms of are you ready to partner?
And Helene, one thing, you were able to share some of the results of that study with me prior to today, and one of the things that really struck me is how similar everyone's situation is.
Right.
The data was very consistent, and so regardless, I think, of what your role is or what type of industry you're in, you can really learn from each other because everyone's trying to work towards that, and the issues each group faces seemed very, very similar to me. And I think, you know, that's a part of a point that you started off with, which is really around the metrics and understanding objectives. I mean, some of the things that we found early on and we still find is that, you know, you bring different groups together to work on a team and everyone's objectives are very, very different. And sometimes they're in direct opposition to each other. And you've really got to try to address that early on so that you can move in the same direction. Because what might be a win for one group is completely a loss for another, and you've got to get a commonality. So I think that's very, very important. But I was struck by that in the study.
I think just getting your house in order. One of a couple of things we've done that is quite interesting. In supply chain and R&D, we have established customer specific innovation groups, and they're rewarded purely on the customer innovation. Yeah, I talked about our Kick Center earlier. We have a funnel. I was actually at it yesterday in Inglewood Cliffs, and the incremental turnover coming out of that is 100 million. The projects we're going to put through in the next, I think it's 3 to 6 months. And that's purely driven, as I say, we've got a team now, supply chain and R&D, focused purely on customer-driven innovation. Yeah? And that's how they're rewarded.
That's great. Yeah.
So now let's go. One of the things you might be gathering from our study is that the soft elements, the so-called soft elements of collaboration, tend to be the most important ones to drive successful innovation as opposed to new technology tools and things like that. Here's one that we struggle with all the time, and frankly, we struggle internally with our clients. Cameron and I have talked about this a lot, around trust in innovation. How are you getting trust with innovation partners when, frankly, even within an R&D department in a company, you may not have much trust?
What are you trying to say, George? Gosh, you asked me this. I give a negative example of how to lose trust, and it's very interesting for me as I look back in my career. When I was younger, I moved to Japan and worked in Japan for 3 years. And this isn't about customer collaboration, but I learned two big things in Japan. One was the need to plan, and the other one was really the necessity to build a good relationship founded on trust. And I went out there and established, actually, it was deodorants and it was an aerosol capability in local manufacturing. And, of course, I get in there, look at it and think, oh, gosh, yeah, cost structure, we can change that, bring in a foreign supplier, et cetera, et cetera. They bought into it. We didn't have a strong relationship. Sales went through the roof. The foreign supplier couldn't supply. And basically we lost trust, and I lost trust, and it was me because I pushed it. I was the person in charge. And I reckon for 2 years there, they didn't trust or listen to me, yeah? Mm. Which was an incredibly painful lesson, yeah? And given in terms of value share, you know, we're number one in the world in deodorants and absolutely massive, and that was a number two value market. It sort of hit me quite hard. I learned a lesson, yeah? So I don't have an answer for you, George, and maybe you're trying to tell me something about my
don't
teams.
Be like
but,
him.
Yeah? But a serious point, I mean, trust is, you know, that was my big learning when I was, 13 years ago when I was in Japan.
So I think we also heard earlier that it starts with some personal relationships.
Yeah, absolutely.
But how do you translate that into structural relationships between innovation partners?
An example, I'll build on your Japan example a little bit differently, but you know, Japan is a very relationship-driven market. It's very complex, and what we've gotten to in terms of working both with our bottling partner and with retail partners that we want to embark on collaborative innovation is to be very, very clear around communicating a consistent vision and then really laying out here are the big what's and the who's. And have gone so far as we've actually created one-page documents where the senior most sponsors, executive sponsors, sign off on that. We celebrate it with the signing party saying this is the collaboration work that we're going to go do together. And we've actually framed those and put them into the offices so that everyone can see it. And, you know, you find a lot, there's a lot of turnover. These aren't short-term projects. Some of them are multi, two, three-year type projects. And so that's a good reminder of who the senior sponsor was, what the vision was, who was going to do what, and to really formalize it. And in a culture like Japan, I think that's very, very important because of the symbol that it sends to the organization of that commitment.
That's great. I think those two examples are terrific, and I would agree totally that trust is so important. I think in my industry, generally, you know, retailers are always looking for, you know, what's the best price that they can get a product for and how quickly can they get it. And sometimes at the expense of the manufacturer or the agent and factory that's delivering that. And if you're going to have a long-term relationship, as we do with our partners in China that manufacture our goods, you have to be willing to kind of lose some to win some. And I think that if you go into it with just looking at what your needs are for the immediate or for your company, I think you'll have difficulty in keeping a trust going.
Excellent. Those were the main points of the study, the main points that we wanted to cover. I think we still have a few minutes left, and I'd like to open it up to the group if they'd like to ask this distinguished group of panelists some questions.
That's the worst. Yeah.
Apparently it's not us.
Good, I'll do that. Sorry. Oops. Sense of humor.
In the spirit of open collaboration, over the last few years there's been a lot of buzz about revolution in innovation through incentivized competition, whether it be the XPRIZE sponsoring first private space travel around the moon, or it be the recent Netflix, you know, come up with a new algorithm to help us guess what our customers would buy. I'd like the panel to comment on, have they looked at competition as a way to, you know, bring a new spirit of innovation in their organizations?
Good question.
Gosh, I can sort of touch on it. I've looked actually with Lloyds Banking in the UK, yeah, into the banking industry, you know, what's been happening there and how they're going to use incentives out there. I'm actually working on that at the moment to see how can we bring some of the thoughts that they've had and bring it into the company. I don't really want to say much more than that, but I do think it's very interesting, and I was absolutely surprised by some of the results that they shared with me. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, it's spot on, because one of the things that I also feel is that the term's been around for a long time, and people have focused on the how, as Julie was saying, and what you're driving there with that question is back to the what and getting people focused on the what, because it's outcome focused we've got to drive to. And I feel that's where a lot of people, perhaps the wheels have spun. Yeah.
I would just add that one of the things we're kind of focused on is we don't think we're there yet. And so we're focused on trying to hit a lot of singles and maybe not the home runs. And so how do you consistently reward and share of those successes and say those then build up to scoring runs versus the big home run? Because, you know, particularly in working with our customers, we've still got a lot to learn and a long way to go. And I think that celebrating those things that are done well has been important. And we don't have an incentive type program behind that that specifically calls that out. But you know, we try to recognize success and also you know, reward the process and the learnings as we go forward.
I would agree with Julie. I think one of the things, it's not really so much competitive directly collaboration or incentives, but I think there's a big opportunity in retail to partner with other retailers and combine product to work more towards her needs and her schedule from a lifestyle standpoint. And even when we've had, you know, this is very kind of much smaller microcosm base, but even when we've had events in our stores in the evenings, if we've had great success if we can get cosmetic companies and other companies to partner and then maybe do a makeover or those types of things. And we've had a lot of success where we can get together and do things together. But again, we have a long way to go and a lot to learn.
Do you have any lessons to share or insights?
Yeah.
And I was just going to say that we do have a couple of clients that have tried to incentivize competition by setting up kind of skunk works groups within their own companies to compete against the more traditional forms of innovation, because they've been getting beat by small, nimble competitors, so they've tried to create potentially internally their own small, nimble competitor.
But back to the metrics point, this isn't so much competition, but if you do set, you know, X amount of innovation to come from other sources, I think it changes people's mindset. Rather than being even internal or customer, you can look at from, you know, from the open innovation standpoint, from a lot of different sources.
And with that, we are at the end of session. We do have some a limited quantity of the study, if you'd like to pick them up later in the session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.